Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chew Manchu, and I'm here with my friend Sam, my co-host, as well as our producer Rachel Holloway and our intern and producer Mayar Graywall. Hey guys.
Hey Chris.
Hello.
Hi.
Tonight we have a guest, an amazing guest, Dr. Kaylin Riley, to discuss highly sensitive children. But first, Sam, you want to remind us about the show?
I'd be happy to. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
Tonight, we have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Kaylin Riley. She is a pediatrician, a highly sensitive person, and a mother of three amazing highly sensitive children. She works as an academic newborn hospitalist in Dayton in Cincinnati, Ohio, and previously worked as a mostly outpatient pediatrician at Wright-Patt Air Force Base until she left the military in summer of 2023. She loves teaching residents and med students. She also has a deep passion for educating parents and children about the highly sensitive trait. She reports recently experiencing an undeniable call to educate pediatric professionals about the trait as well. Mission: change the world one highly sensitive child at a time.
I think our listeners are really going to love this episode. Everyone enjoy the show!
Yay! Yay!
Well, hello, Dr. Kaylin Riley. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm honestly super starstruck. I love this podcast. I never in a thousand years would have imagined I'd be considered an expert in anything. So I'm just super jazzed to be here with you guys.
No, we're super excited to have you. But first, because we're an informal group, is it okay if we call you by your first name, Kaylin?
Absolutely.
Excellent. So we'd like to start off with some rapid fire questions just to get to know you a little better. So could you give us, you know, a couple lines about yourself, who you are, and maybe something outside of medicine that you like to do?
Yeah. So I'm a nursery hospitalist by trade right now. I previously was in the Air Force and mostly outpatient general pediatrics, but I separated last summer and have been a nursery hospitalist since then, and I'm loving it. People used to say my specialty in medicine was talking scared moms off the ledge, and that's exactly what I do most days. I am the mother of three sensitive children of varying degrees, wife of an amazing husband who takes care of all my kids. And I am just super excited to talk about this stuff. It impacted me a lot personally and professionally. And I just think it's a really neat topic.
Awesome. Awesome. Mayor, do you want to start off by asking one question?
What do you think is a book that every physician should read?
That's honestly the easiest one, I think. Outlive by Peter Attia. It is all about what he calls medicine 3.0, just about preventative medicine and actually caring for ourselves so that we don't have healthcare problems to have to come to the healthcare system for. And it's awesome. It's a lot of science, a lot of colloquial, just talking about life in general, ends with some really neat emotional tidbits. It's great.
Yeah, I hear a lot about Peter Attia. He's always ranked higher than us on podcasts. So.
That's super awkward. He's great, though. He's such a good podcaster. He's right there in line with you guys.
He is. Yeah. Absolutely.
He's got wisdom, or we have maybe something else. We'll just put it that way.
I don't know what else we have.
I don't know either. That's why I said we'll leave it as something else. I was hoping someone else would fill in the blank. Right, exactly. We have something special, which is great.
It is.
Yeah, no, we got something. And you know what we can do? I'm going to try to transition this. We got advice. So what's the best advice you ever received as a learner or even as a teacher? You know, whatever you want.
Yeah. So I remember being a medical student. I think I was a third year and I was on a general inpatient medicine rotation. We ordered some CT scan or some sort of radiology test that was very much a CYA, as we call it. CYB, let's be peds friendly, cover your butt. And the radiologist actually called me because I put the order in, and asked me, you know, why do you guys need this? And I was like, listen, I'm going to be honest with you guys. It's like, you know, it's a CYA thing. That's what my tending said. And he's like, yeah, I figured. And you're a learner. So I thought I'd call you and correct course because I want you to learn good medicine. If you are practicing good medicine, your butt will be covered. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's fair. He said, I'm going to cancel the study. If your attending has a question, tell him to call me. I said, okay. And I let my attending know, fully anticipating that they were going to be crazy furious. And I don't think that the learning point was lost on them, honestly. I think they understood exactly what he was trying to teach me.
Yeah, I like that too, because it's a positive look. It's like, look, you do a good job.
Exactly.
And you're going to be good, you know, rather than making sure you don't do a bad job.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I like that. I like that.
Rachel, do you got anything you want to ask?
Yes. Kind of along the same lines. I like to ask about favorite failures, and I like to ask that question specifically favorite failure because it's a more positive twist on something that is typically construed as negative, right? So... what is your favorite failure? And it can be in medicine or outside of medicine too.
Honestly, my favorite failure kind of is both. And it's quite pertinent to this podcast. It was me assuming that my amazing stepson had something really wrong with him and kind of digging in, trying to figure out exactly what that was. And that's exactly how I stumbled into the highly sensitive trait and understood him and figured out what was going on with him. And now I hopefully can help a lot of other people, not just him and me.
That's fantastic. Well, speaking of which, we should probably get into our episode.
Whether this is your first episode or you've been with us since day one, you know our goal has always been to share clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge in pediatric medicine. So let's talk about something that actually changed my day-to-day as a hospitalist, figs. I can't walk into a clinic or hospital without seeing people in fig scrubs. And I get it. I wear them too. They're incredibly soft, form-fitting, and durable. And it's not just us. If you've been watching a certain popular emergency room drama on TV that may or may not take place in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, yep, they're in figs too. These scrubs get it. That's what drew me in and what keeps me coming back. And because we work with kids and kids come with messes, I love that figs are antimicrobial. When stuff gets on your scrubs, and it will, you just wash them and they come out wrinkle-free. I've washed mine over 50 times and they still look brand new. All of that and so much more is why we've teamed up with figs. Now, Cribsiders listeners can get 15% off. Just go to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX to get 15% off.
Mayar, do you want to start us off with our patient?
Yeah, sounds great. So this is a case from Cashlock Children's. Nora is an 8-year-old presenting with her mother for her 8-year-old well child check. And when discussing her development and behavior, her mother is concerned that Nora has frequent emotional outbursts and has difficulty coping with change. Diving a little deeper, her mom states that Nora often cries easily and intensely, particularly in response to criticism or perceived failure. She becomes overwhelmed in situations such as tests or performances where she feels she's being observed or evaluated. She is sensitive to loud noises, bright lights, and strong smells. She prefers to avoid loud environments and becomes distressed in crowded places like shopping malls or busy playgrounds. Even as a young child, Nora showed deep empathy and concern for others, especially surrounding distressing events. She is very perceptive of subtle changes in her environment and the emotions of those around her. Nora prefers quiet, structured activities and becomes anxious with sudden changes in routine. She often seeks solitude to recover from overwhelming situations. She excels academically, but becomes easily stressed by classroom dynamics and noisy environments. Her teachers note that she prefers working alone or in small, quiet groups. Nora otherwise has met all of her developmental milestones and has no other chronic medical conditions. Our first question is, what is a highly sensitive child and what is sensory processing sensitivity?
I have nothing else to say. Like, honestly, the case completely sums up what a highly sensitive child is and sounds a lot like me at 8 years old. So sensory processing sensitivity is kind of the academic and the research terminology for highly sensitive. And it's not just children, HSCs, highly sensitive children, but HSPs, highly sensitive people, and not just humans for that matter. There's like hundreds of other animal species that we've also identified. 20% of them are just a little more perceptive and sensitive to their environment than the other 80%. It's not a pathology in and of itself. It's just kind of a temperament trait. It's just a way that 20% of people experience the world and interact with the world around them, but it is different from 80% of other people. And you know, as humans always perceive anything that's different as pathological. So that's why they often get kind of mislabeled or misclassified as having something wrong with them when it's really just kind of who they are.
So what are some common characteristics of these highly sensitive children? You know, we kind of gave a good case and you're like, hey, this is it. But if you wouldn't mind kind of going through some of the classic, you know, kind of signs that we would see, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. So it kind of, to boil it down into one sentence, these kids are just, they just have very finely tuned nervous systems. People in the field often use an acronym, DOES, DOES, to kind of describe things. And I find that really helpful clinically to kind of break it down in my head. So D is for depth of processing, and that's kind of the core of the trait. These kids just think harder and longer about everything. They're not okay with just looking at the leaves and the branches of the tree. They want to see the root. They want to see the pattern in the bark. They're not okay with the surface answer to things. They're the why type of kids. Ironically, they sometimes look very inattentive, and parents often will bring them into you, concerned that they have inattentive ADHD, but it's not inattention for them, it's overattention more than anything else. They get so wrapped up and lost in processing all of this information around them, and they're just constantly taking that in and thinking so deeply about it that they can kind of disappear to the rest of us. O of the acronym is kind of the hard part of the trait. That's over-arousal or overstimulation. And as a highly sensitive person myself, I can tell you that it often really stinks. Basically, the highly sensitive child's nervous system just jumps into fight or flight with such ease and agility, you would think that they were like born by a tiger ready to eat them. They have bigger stress hormone spikes. Their physiologic response is bigger to those hormone spikes. It's a lot of information that they're constantly taking in over time, and they just get really overstimulated chronically by that. It's kind of an important concept for parents to understand too, because we all know, you know, when your adrenaline system is kind of in charge, your monkey brain is in charge. And so these kids can look really off the chain when they're stressed out about stuff, and they get stressed out more easily. But yeah, they just everything is kind of a lot for them. Emotionally and physically. And then the E is for empathic or emotionally reactive. These kids have just huge feelings about everything. They're sensitive to TV shows, to the movies that they're watching, art, music. And it's probably because everything just speaks to their big feelings and they finally feel like seen in the world. All five of their senses are very much just in turbo drive. They smell things other people can't smell. They can hear things. Lights, crowds, everything is just a lot to them. They're more sensitive to touch, to emotions, to other people's emotions as well as their own. And they're not just more sensitive to, you know, negative experiences, if you will. They're more more sensitive to positive experiences as well. They care a lot about other people, a lot about other people's feelings and their experience of the world. Sometimes they absorb other people's feelings as strongly as their own. They're very much empaths, not sympaths, where they can just see where people are feeling things, but they really get in there in the trenches with other people, whether they want to or not. They can kind of have what I call a justice chip for that reason. They're very concerned about fairness and equality, and they just get really super disturbed by injustice of any form. That's very bothersome to them. And then S is for sensitive to subtle stimuli. So they have gut instincts that are just the size of Texas, and they're super rarely wrong about anything. They pick up little details that everyone else misses. They're the ones who notice somebody's had a haircut, or you have new pillows, or your curtains are different. It's really hard for parents because you can't fake anything with them. They know what you're thinking and what you're feeling before you do. It's kind of tiresome sometimes. You can tell them, I'm not mad at you, buddy. And if you're upset or you have been upset, they know. And then they're mad at you for lying to them because that's not fair. Sometimes the part actually that parents will think that they have like mild autism spectrum because they're just so sensitive to various sensory stimulus. They can get really overwhelmed by textures, by temperature, smell, taste. They can be really picky with eating because of those things. They might really hate loud noises and want to wear the little noise canceling headphones to try to avoid that. They can struggle with interpersonal relationships because they're so stressed out and worried about what the other person is experiencing, and are they having fun? Are they, you know, concerned about how they're feeling about them? So it can look like a lot of different things because of that.
That was an excellent description. And I think I thank you for explaining all of that to us because I definitely know people in my life and I've seen patients that have these kinds of qualities, and it's super helpful to have it explained like that and laid out like that. Something I want to ask, and we'll get into more of like the differential, what other disorders can sometimes be seen in or have similar qualities to highly sensitive people. But something that I like to think of, like when I, like this case was great because it gave a lot of information that is like really informative. But when I have a 30-minute well child check, I'm touching on a lot of other things, and I often don't have the tools or the time to be able to really ask these really pointed questions to get such a great history as we have in this case. I do often ask about academic performance and in social interactions, you know, what kinds of relationships do these kids have with their peers and their siblings and their family members? And then, you know, do the teachers note anything at school? How's their academic performance? And so my question for you is, how does being a highly sensitive child influence their social interactions and their academic performance? Like, what kinds of things as a pediatrician can we, you know, what things should we perk our ears up at?
Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, in terms of academics, because those are really like the two big domains, right? We think about them socially and academically at that age. Academically, they're usually doing really well. They understand all the concepts because they're digging in so deeply on stuff, and they don't just understand, they're not memorizing, like they really understand the core concepts. So they're very smart, very capable. They in the classroom can look very inattentive because they get so lost in, you know, processing some specific thing or thinking about something, you know, that happened in the cafeteria, and then they get kind of, you know, distracted by that basically. They can get really overwhelmed with relatively simple questions. You know, the teacher just asking, you know, what was your favorite thing this weekend? Just kind of going round robin around the classroom, and they're thinking about 12 different things, and what am I supposed to say, and how should I say it, and which one would be best perceived by my peers? And then they just freeze, right? And so they just look like they're this like really awkward lost kid in the classroom when actually they have tons of great ideas to share. Socially, they can be kind of isolated. And I think most of the time that's them shying away from too much sensory stimulus. So, you know, other kids, and this, I see this a lot with boys specifically, you know, they can be rambunctious and they're loud and they're physical. And that's a lot for a highly sensitive child. And so they kind of retreat like, I don't know. I don't think I want to do, you know, a play date with so-and-so. And maybe I'm afraid of play dates in general because of the last two or three experiences I have, because they very much rely on and tap into their prior experiences to guide their decision-making moving forward. But it's so funny, like if you put two highly sensitive kids together, they just flourish. Like they understand each other and they're interested in similar things and they just seem to really jive. And they're not, you know, we think of highly sensitive kids and probably everything we've described so far makes you think of an introvert, but about 30% of them are actually extroverts. So some of them very much crave, you know, social interaction, and they're rejuvenated by social interaction. It's just a lot for them. And so they sometimes need a little more guidance than, you know, the other 80% of kids in terms of how to interact with people, how to share with people when you're not enjoying something, you know, in a way that's not bothersome to them, and that you can share your needs and your experience and your wants without, you know, them shutting you down. And what do you do when people respond poorly to that? How can you interface with them so that you can still have good relationships?
So throughout this discussion so far, you have actually mentioned a lot of other diagnoses that sort of are similar or have overlapping features. I think you talked about ADHD to begin with. You also mentioned autism spectrum disorder, mm-hmm. and you said the word anxiety several times as well. Mm-hmm. It sounds like there may be multiple other things that can look like highly sensitive children, or is it possible that some patients, some children may have multiple comorbid issues at the same time? Can you describe a little bit about some of the differentials that we're going to see and how we're sort of going to tease that out?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I'll first point out that these kids absolutely can have pathology. The highly sensitive trait in and of itself is not pathological, but they can have pathology. They can have autism spectrum, they can have ADHD, they can have anxiety, depression, a broken foot, anything, same as any other kid. I will say a lot of these kids come in with concerns for ODD, oppositional defiance, and PDA, pathological demand avoidance. And I'll pause and say that, honestly, I don't care for either of those diagnoses. I don't think that they're helpful, and they can kind of pigeonhole a kid and label them in such a way that people haven't even met them yet, and they see that on their IEP or they see that on their medical history, and they've already made so many decisions about that kid that are not fair. But these kids can overlap a lot. So just the inherent traits of high sensitivity overlap a lot with, you know, various pathologies. And that's important, I think, for us to know as clinicians. We, you know, kind of briefly touched on how they can sort of look like inattentive ADHD. They can look like hyperactive ADHD if the way that they discharge or handle their big feelings, big emotions about things is externally. So if they're yelling to cope, or they're pushing, they're having to do things with their body, they have a lot of frenetic energy to try to discharge some of that excess emotion and excess feeling. They, you know, certainly can look like a hyperactive ADHD kid. I think that in terms of autism spectrum, that sensitivity to stimulus, just to noises, smells, tags in their clothes, changes in their routine, all of that kind of makes parents think about autism spectrum. You know, in terms of anxiety and depression, they're certainly higher risk for those things. And it probably makes sense, just even what we've talked about so far about the trait, that they would be higher risk for that. They're just constantly processing all of this extra information that's around them. And that information is not always good. Like, the world is not unfair. It's full of injustice and uncertainty. And they're pondering on that more deeply than many adults do. And of course, they feel anxious and depressed sometimes. And then you compound on that, you know, they have these big feelings, and so often society is invalidating those. You know, they're losing it about something that we perceive as not that big of a deal. And what do we say? Oh, for Pete's sakes, you know, you're doing this to yourself. You're making a mountain out of a molehill. It's not that big of a deal. And then they're not just grappling with the big feelings that they have that are very innate to who they are. And they can't help those, but they also feel wrong about those feelings. They're being told that their experience of the world is incorrect. And that just, I mean, that makes them feel sad and worried. And that makes sense, I think. You know, all of these symptoms, though, with highly sensitive children are going to be way more pronounced when they're stressed. And stress can look like a lot of different things. They could be sick. They might be tired. They're hungry. I feel like the term hangry, it was like invented for these kids when they get hungry and they just completely lose control of their emotional regulation skills. If they're performing, if they're in front of somebody, that can be really stressful. They're taking a test or something like that. Ross Green, he's a wonderful child psychologist and has written several books and has a lot of really cool information out there, but he wrote a book called The Explosive Child. And something he says in there is, if the only time a child looks as if he has bipolar disorder is when he's frustrated, that's not bipolar disorder. That's a learning disability in the domains of flexibility and frustration tolerance. And I just think that's the coolest statement. It very much helps you kind of, you know, distinguish these kids from the pathologies that they overlap with. They do not look disordered in any way when they're calm. And they're not often calm because they're dealing with so many feelings and so much stress. But they're actually super bright. They're very mature. They're perceptive. Like, these are the kids that everyone is so impressed with. They think they're, you know, wise beyond their years. But once they're stressed and that adrenaline system, the monkey brain is in charge, all of these kind of concerning symptoms will show up, the stuff that the parents are bringing these kids to you about. But you can probably imagine, you know, for a kid who's chronically stressed, that it's really tough to tease that out. It does, you know, enter multiple domains. So the kids that are living in poverty, they're living with racial disparities, they're living with transphobia or homophobia or, you know, phobia of their religion, or they're dealing with chronic abuse, or they just have a very authoritarian parent at home, you know, especially if there's corporal punishment or anything like that in their home. All of those can be just kind of chronic, perpetual stressors for them, such that all of their behavior looks disordered. And it's not inherent to them. It's kind of a response to their environment. And then, you know, you can imagine these kids, you know, they get brought in for various things and, oh, you know, my kid's doing this and this and this. What's wrong with him? What's going on? And they kind of internalize that. They can feel and sense that they're causing stress to everybody because they feel everybody else's feelings, you know, just like they do their own. And they can get very derailed. Shame is kryptonite for these kids. So they can end up acting all kinds of different ways, trying to process, you know, the burden that they perceive themselves to be on their family. So I think we have to be really careful with these kids when you evaluate them and treat them for anything. Because again, they can have these things and we should not withhold treatment for these kids. But they can also just be HSEs whose, you know, support system, their teachers, their family, their whatever, they just don't kind of understand them and they don't really understand themselves. And their little nervous systems are just kind of on fire because of that. And the treatment for those kids is not stimulants or particular therapy or an IEP at school. They just need for people to see them and to understand who they are and to help them understand, you know, themselves a little bit better and to co-regulate with them when they're, you know, overwhelmed, and to help them understand self-regulation skills so that they can move through life, you know, and be able to do things their own way.
So you briefly brought up socioeconomic pressures. My one question about this is, mm-hmm. Do we know about prevalence? Do we see this more often in certain situations, or is that, do we not have any studies to sort of look at that?
So we don't have great studies, but I'll tell you, you know, from what we have, it's 20% of every different subsect of society. So there's not, you know, a higher prevalence with various different groups. I will say that the experience, though, I think of being a highly sensitive person is very different for various, you know, groups of people. So anybody that society says should be tougher. So I think about boys, people from a lower socioeconomic status, Black families, people dealing with, you know, chronic generational trauma, all of them are supposed to be tougher. That's kind of the message that they internalize throughout life. And so for them to be perceived as highly sensitive would be a negative thing. And so they have this very different experience, you know, compared to other people who might grow up in a family that even celebrates their sensitivity or learns about it and understands it and, you know, just applies everything they know about it and they're totally cool with everything. So there's not a difference in prevalence, you know, amongst races or socioeconomic status, but the experience of the trait, I think, is very different for various people.
Summer's here. More sun, more light, more time to do all the things that make summer so special. And the number one thing you don't want to be doing all summer? Working in the hospital. Well, you can't get out of that one, but how about spending hours cooking inside? That's where Factor comes in. Factor chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals are ready in just 2 minutes, taking the hassle out of eating well. With 45 weekly menu options, you can pick gourmet meals that fit your summer gains and goals. Choose from options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and more. Factor powers your day, sun up to sundown. With nutritious breakfasts, on-the-go lunches, premium dinners, and guilt-free snacks and desserts, Factor has your whole day covered. In medicine, time is our most valuable resource. If you're a resident working 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., how are you going to cook, sleep, and exercise? Well, that's easy. Use Factor and remove all the cooking time with delicious meals. If you're a student, how are you going to go to rotations from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m., study, cook, exercise, and sleep? Well, same thing. Factor is ready in just 2 minutes. All the meals are nutritious, delicious, and ready to go. Enjoy more this summer. Get Factor if you want all the flavor and none of the fuss. So, Cribsiders listeners, get started at factormeals.com/cribsiders50off and use code cribsiders50off to get 50% off plus free shipping on your first box. That's code cribsiders50off at factormeals.com/cribsiders50off for 50% off plus free shipping. factormeals.com/cribsiders50off.
Amir, do you want to ask a little bit about diagnosis?
You're muted. I'm on mute. So how do you diagnose SPS? Are there any screening tools that are useful in identifying an HSC?
Yeah, so there's definitely genetic markers, but like we can leave all of that stuff to the poor bench researchers, bless their hearts. Really, this is a very much a clinical thing. There's no blood test for it. I mean, there is a blood test for it, but you shouldn't use that. It's fairly easy to just ask a couple of questions, and I sort of use the DOES mnemonic in my head to just do this like very mini interview with parents. And I'll tell you, of the highly sensitive kids, half of the parents are like, oh yes, like for sure, slam dunk, I feel seen. Some of them, you can like see that their gears are processing, and for whatever reason, they're not ready to just be like, yeah, for sure, that's it. But you can just tell. And maybe that's because I'm a highly sensitive person and I'm watching their cues. I don't know. But you can just tell that their gears are turning. And often, you know, I'll give them like a resource sheet, and we can post that in the show notes as well for anybody to hand out to any parent. But I'll give them that, and they'll come back in like 2 or 3 weeks and be like, yeah, that all jives. That lines up. I feel that. There are two kind of online screeners. So Elaine Aaron is a PhD, and she's, I would say, probably the foremost researcher in the field about high sensitivity. She has a screener on her website, and it's highlysensitiveperson.com/test. Parents can take it. They can also take it kind of on behalf of their child, if that makes sense. And her website is just generally a wealth of information about various things about the trait. Focused most of her career on adult highly sensitive people, but you know, adult highly sensitive people used to be highly sensitive children. So it all lines up. And then Michael Pluis is like a more of a bench researcher on everything. He has some tests, he calls them, on his website, and that's sensitivityresearch.com. They're, again, for adults and for children. I like his because there's two versions for the kids. There's one for the younger kids that the parent takes on their behalf, and then there's one for older kids where they take it themselves, which I think is cool. And then the results that he spits out on his website are kind of like a sensitivity score, like a spectrum pictograph, and I really like that kind of concept. And I think it's helpful for parents and for kids to just kind of know where they fall along this spectrum, if you will. Like, am I super highly sensitive? Am I an orchid? Am I medium sensitive? I'm more of a tulip? Am I not sensitive at all? I'm a dandelion? And just kind of seeing where people line up. Those scales, honestly, I just think they would be so cool if like they were part of our just standard checkups. Like, they're coming in for their four-year-old well check, you know, taking those screeners right alongside their MCHAT and their ASQs and their PHQ-9s and their GADs. I think if we could, you know, pick out these kids early in life, we could help their parents kind of understand them better and help them approach them a little bit better and parent them differently, because they very much need a very different playbook compared to other kiddos. Honestly, I think it'd be really helpful for us to know which parents are highly sensitive as well, because that can kind of change your interactions with them. I think it would be equally beneficial for them to take a quiz and have us be able to know that. You know, and I say 4-year-old, but there's actually no validated screening scale under 4, but I work with newborns all day, every day, and I can pick these babies out in the newborn nursery every day. And I've like done the math in my head and it's 20% of them. And I can just tell the way that they, you know, respond to exam maneuvers. These are the kids, you unswaddle them and they're just, whoa, and they're just screaming hysterically. They get hangry. The parents tell them like, I cannot get my boob in their mouth fast enough. Like I'm working on it and they're hysterical. And like, I mean, how cool would that be if I could identify for these parents if their baby is highly sensitive? This is who your kid is. Here's the different playbook on them. And it's, you know, not your average kid. Parenting your highly sensitive child for a successful life. And I could just send them home from the newborn nursery with that. I just think it would be really cool if we could do that. It's a dream of mine, but I'm going to start with educating pediatricians about it first.
To kind of just ask a follow-up question that I was literally going to ask this question. You kind of answered it already, but I was going to talk about the age a little bit. You know, Nora here is a case who commonly presents at 8. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that we're talking about is helping to differentiate between some of these more pathologic pieces using screener tests or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. You know, by 8, I would have done my MCHAT. I would have already kind of seen some other things. I could have even gotten in early intervention and said, hey, mm-hmm. we really have some social pieces. But when are these parents really bringing their kids in for these? Because if they're bringing them closer to that 2 and 3 year old age, this is where it's going to get a little bit tough to differentiate, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yes and no. Again, I think if you, you know, kind of ask some questions that very much line up with the DOES acronym, you can kind of perceive these kids. You also can look into the family history. So this is genetic 100% with clear epigenetic, you know, impact to it and to the expression. But this is very much a genetic thing. So if, you know, one or both of the parents are highly sensitive, siblings are highly sensitive, you can have a much better idea that this kid is also going to be highly sensitive. One study that's kind of coming to mind where, so there's a couple different genes that are involved in high sensitivity that we can like pick out this sort of polygenic sequence, if you will. One of them is the D4 dopamine receptor. And there was a study that kind of looked at children with one of these polymorphisms in this particular gene and their response to either like a calm, autonomy-promoting, mindful parenting style versus a more authoritarian, you know, traditional parenting style, if you will, and their developmental milestones. So they tracked them at 15, 18 months, and then again at 4 years old. And the highly sensitive kids who had this gene polymorphism, you know, responded not well to the authoritarian lifestyle. And so you could already see that they were having kind of sensation-seeking behaviors at the 15 and 18 months. So these were the kids that were like sort of popping up positive on the MCHAT in terms of, you know, scared of the vacuum noises and, you know, having some self-stim type behaviors, constantly seeking, you know, tactile feedback. And then those kids at age 4 had lower executive functioning scores as well. And that's compared to the kids who had the more just kind of calm, mindful parenting environment. And they did great, whether they were highly sensitive or not. So there's definitely things that you can pick out at various ages. I feel like there's kind of two peaks when parents will bring these kids to you. And this is just my opinion, I think that colic is highly sensitive babies. I think that they experience the fourth trimester very differently. And like what percentage of babies have colic, right? About 20%. So I think that you're going to get these babies who are just not happy with anything. Like what's going on? Is it the formula? Is it my breast milk? Are there, you know, something wrong with them? What's happening? And it's a baby developmentally experiencing normal experiences in life, but having bigger reactions to them. But they're very distressing to parents. And that to me is the benefit of maybe identifying it for these parents ahead of time so that they don't feel like they have to like present to care constantly and have a brain MRI and all of these various evaluations and PPIs for their GERD. And when it's probably not that, it's not the spit up that's upsetting them. It's just, you know, life. Life is hard on the outside. And then I think that school age kids, I would say like second to fourth grade is probably the next higher prevalence that you'll kind of see them coming in with, you know, the concerns about inattentive sort of stuff. They're starting to show anxious behaviors, and it's because developmentally those kids are starting to care more about what other people think of them and other people's perception of them. And they're starting to see that they're a little bit different from most of their peers, and that's bothersome. And then there's another huge spike in the teenage years, and I probably don't have to elaborate on that. They're very in tune with how other people perceive them and what they're thinking of them. They're, you know, taking in more adult information, if you will. They're not as sheltered from, you know, the ills of the world, and they struggle. They struggle with that and with, you know, trying to grapple with what the world is, who they are in the world, and how they're going to navigate things.
So you're saying a little earlier that it'd be great to add this, you know, hopefully you wish that some of these highly sensitive child screeners could be put alongside all the other screening that we do in our primary care setting. You know, so as we are thinking about our highly sensitive children who are in our practice, you mentioned about, you know, putting it next to the PHQ-9 and the GAD-7, because we've talked about maybe some overlap between, you know, depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. What are some other types of screeners would you use to assess, or just generally assess a patient with that you think is highly sensitive? Would you go ahead and make sure they got PHQ-9, GAD-7? You know, if they're on the younger standpoint, would you make sure that they got that MCHAP before they're, you know, 30 months old? Would you make sure they got Vanderbilt's done in their school age children? Like, are these typical ones? And if they're, and what are other things that we should consider doing?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think all of the standard screeners are super important for them, and very reasonable to get Vanderbilts on these kids. And that's a very common presenting concern for these families. And then just the way you interpret them matters. So the highly sensitive teenagers who are experiencing some sort of known or unknown, you know, chronic duress at school or with something that's going on with them, you know, internally or externally, they're the ones who are going to have a PHQ-9 of, you know, 19 one visit because you caught them on a bad day. And then the next time it's going to be a 2. And it's not because they're making either of those up. It's because their experience of each day is so different. You know, the MCHATs, you just have to kind of take those, you know, I mean, if they're screening concerning for autism, I think it's worth, you know, going to see a developmental pediatrician and just knowing that, and maybe kind of like setting parental expectations. Like, I kind of have a hunch that maybe you have a kid with sensory processing sensitivity. They just have a very finely tuned nervous system, and it makes sense that they're displaying XYZ because of that. You know, obviously, if, you know, he is on the autism spectrum, we need to know that sooner rather than later. Outcomes are a lot better if we catch it and, you know, get them plugged in to the right resources early. So why don't we just send you to a developmental pediatrician? I just want you to know that, you know, this is kind of my hunch. I'm wondering if this is it. You know, so don't be surprised. Don't be alarmed if they screen negative. I see these symptoms and they're real. You're not making them up. They just might not be autism spectrum. You know, I think you take all of this information in kind of in the context of knowing or suspecting that they're highly sensitive. Vanderbilt's classic, you know, explanation. So, you know, we've all learned in our training that ADHD has to be present in multiple environments, right? Like, we all know that cognitively, but how many times are you pressured in clinic by a really desperate and concerned parent? They come in and the parental scales are one thing and the teacher scales are something completely different. And what do? We diagnose them with ADHD and we send them home with a stimulant. You have to kind of tease out because it could be either one. It could be that the child is really struggling in school and they're totally fine at home. It could be vice versa. The kid's really struggling at home. Maybe they live in an authoritarian household. Maybe, you know, they're constantly told that their feelings are wrong and they're squashed and, you know, buck up, shape up, you're taxing the whole family, like, get over it kind of stuff. And that chronically can really change their behavior in the home environment, and it changes their relationships and their family with their siblings, with their parents. And so they're a different kid. at home versus at school. And the teachers are reporting something totally different. This like really bright, thriving kid who pays attention and is really kind to his peers and, you know, listens carefully to instructions and follows the rules and all that kind of stuff. And the parents are just utterly confused. Like, why is it so different one place to the next? So just, you know, all the standard scales, if you're concerned about, you know, XYZ pathology, screen for that the same way that you would any other kid. And just consider high sensitivity. Is this playing into it? Is it explaining all of it? Is it changing, you know, the way that this scale came out today versus the next day? These might be kids that you kind of follow a little more chronologically. Like, I've had families come in with XYZ, you know, concerns about pathologies, and I'll tell them, you know, I have an idea. There's this concept that's old as the hills, but a little bit new to the medical community, you know, sensory processing sensitivity, highly sensitive children. Here's a resource sheet. Humor me. Go home, look at this stuff, listen to a few podcasts, you know, just look into it a little bit and then come back. You know, we can book a telehealth visit in a week or 2 weeks or a month or 6 months or whatever. You know, what do you want to do? And that's honestly a great way for me to gauge kind of the severity, like where this kid is on the sensitivity spectrum and the severity of the problems that people are really experiencing. Some of the parents are like, do you have appointments tomorrow? I'll research it all tonight. And others are like, yeah, we'll see, you know, and some of them come back, some of them don't. So, you know, that's a helpful piece of information too, in terms of screening.
Do you feel like you can never get ahead of charting? Imagine a world where you don't need to think about notes again. Introducing Freed, an AI medical scribe built to free clinicians everywhere. It listens, transcribes, and writes instant clinical notes for you in your style. Freed can be used across all specialties for in-office as well as virtual visits, and it works in multiple languages. Written in your style and ready the moment the visit is over, all you have to do is copy it into your EHR. Freed is HIPAA compliant and only takes seconds to learn. Over 15,000 clinicians, including doctors, APPs, therapists, use Freed to save up to 2 hours every day and free themselves from documentation. Just imagine the great feeling of coming home without any notes hanging over your head. Get back to doing what you love and let Freed do the rest. Start your free trial today, no credit card needed. Use code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe. That's code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe. CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe.
Awesome. So just kind of switching gears a little bit into strategies for treating highly sensitive children and working towards increasing awareness, what interventions or therapies or resources would you recommend for highly sensitive children?
So I think, honestly, the number one intervention and the way that you can help these kids is to help the kids themselves, especially the adolescents and teenagers, and their parents understand what the trait is and understand that it's not a pathology, and just know what it looks like and what it means for them, and that they kind of perceive the world differently, and that's why they feel different. That's why they look different from other kids. And everybody can just kind of like let their shoulders down a little bit at that point, and then just kind of focus on what the kid is showing and how they kind of everybody can sort of adjust their sails accordingly. I do think it's really helpful. And again, we can link this in the show notes. You know, I have just kind of a list of different resources. There's tons of podcasts out there right now. It's like very much exploding in the parenting and the educational communities. We just haven't brought it to the medical community quite yet, that just kind of explain the trait and what it means. And then all of them sort of get into the more nitty-gritty details, like, my kid's freaking out at the holidays. Why? What do I do? My kid seems really disrespectful. What's happening? How do I respond to that? You know, most of them kind of talk about the why of how the kid's responding. You know, it's not genuinely disrespect. It's a kid who feels misunderstood at home, who's being chronically told that their feelings are wrong, their experience of the world is wrong, they can't control it, they internalize the fact that, you know, everybody seems stressed around them, about their behavior and what they're doing and what they're saying. And they turn into this just really maladaptive behavior pattern to kind of cope with that, to discharge that negative energy and to get rid of the shame that they're feeling. Their shame blankets can just like suffocate them. And so they have to throw them off somehow. You know, I think I gave a grand rounds to the Dayton Children's Residence a couple of years ago, and it just kind of gives a nice synopsis of the trait itself and just sort of some general parenting tips and strategies, but it's all about kind of at the core, understanding it and then just responding to them, knowing that that's who they are. And, you know, not only can you not change who they are, but you should kind of respond to them differently. You shouldn't tell them that they're wrong, you know, that their understanding or their experience is incorrect in some way. Validating them is huge. That, you know, a lot of the kind of literature about highly sensitive people actually started with Marsha Linehan, who was the inventor of dialectical behavioral therapy for people with borderline personality disorder. And it was her seeing this subsect of people, probably all highly sensitive people, who responded terribly to traditional therapy strategies that were all like, you're wrong. Let me reframe this for you. Let me tell you how you should think. And they got worse. The longer they were in treatment, the worse they got. And she changed her perspective and started with, I see you. I see what you're experiencing. That must feel really overwhelming. How does that make your body feel? What do you wish you were feeling right now? How can we get you to that point? You're in charge here. It's not the external world pressing upon you. It's you experiencing the world. How can we change your experience so that you're more comfortable in the world?
So one question I have is, you know, you're talking about some of these resources and discussions, you know, with parents, because the kids are spend a lot of time at home with their parents, but many of our children are school age, and if they're not homeschooled, they're going to be spending a lot of time in school. And I feel that sometimes teachers aren't, you know, some teachers are fantastic and are great. We're working with kids. Some may not understand sort of high sensitive children or sensory processing sensitivity. How can we help our teachers in sort of these areas? And, you know, is this, because this is more of a trait, a characteristic, like, is this something that like you can develop an AEP around? Can you discuss that a little bit?
Yeah. So, I mean, I wouldn't think that, you know, they wouldn't qualify for an IEP unless there's a particular diagnosis. And again, these kids may not have a diagnosis that qualifies them for that. Would they qualify for 504 plans? Probably not, but maybe they should. Maybe that would be a great way to kind of introduce them, because then you get this nice little meeting between, you know, the various subsectives of the school, the parent, the teacher, the counselor, the child sometimes, just kind of explaining, you know, this is what we're dealing with and this is how the school can best serve my kid. One of the resources on my resource sheet is a woman named Rachel Bailey. She's also a child, I think a clinical counselor, but she has a podcast on, it actually started out as kind of a parenting podcast. And then at episode 200, she completely switched gears and focused completely on highly sensitive kids, because they're just such an underserved subsect of children, especially the ones who are struggling. And she is a really nice resource that people can just literally email to the teacher and just say, hey, you know, we're coming into the classroom brand new. This is my son. He's amazing. We love him. There's, you know, things that we'd like for you to know about him. This is something you may have already heard about. You know, frame it as like, you know, oh, the educational community is already so aware of this trait. You know, medicine is catching up. We just learned about this. Maybe you already know about it, but here's a resource just in case. And it just kind of walks them through the basics of the trait to kind of help them understand, you know, my kid's going to tick a little bit differently than 80% of the other kids, because it's really important. And again, a lot of teachers do know about this, and we're the ones who are behind right now. A lot of parents know about this, and we're the ones who are behind, but some of them don't. You know, I do find that, just generally speaking, the kids who are in a classroom with a more experienced teacher who's just done this for 8, 10, 12 years, they just kind of intuitively know that 20% of their kids are a little bit different, and they've kind of figured out over the years, if they're a good teacher, you know, how to adapt to them a little differently. But especially the new ones, and especially the ones who don't have kids themselves yet, or if they have kids who are not highly sensitive, this might be like totally out of left field. And these kids do look like ADHD, ODD, you know, whatever different pathology. And so helping them understand, this is what my kid looks like at baseline. Here's how they might respond to, you know, a stressor in the classroom, and here's the best way to respond to them so that you don't amplify the negative situation or the negative behavior, but you can actually kind of bring them back down into the stratosphere and help them do well.
And, you know, as a pediatrician who has, and unfortunately, 20-minute visits or maybe even less, are there some easy coping skills that you recommend that we pass on that are really like really helpful, just like the high yield pieces? Or do you usually say, here's my resource sheet. Here are some great people to listen to learn from. And this is kind of how I pass across that information.
Yeah. So I hand out the resource sheet and I tell them, rule number one, validate and also don't invalidate. Whatever your child is feeling is real. They're not in control of it, and it's appropriate. No feelings are wrong, ever. The end. If you can meet your child where they are, and I tell people, get down on the floor with them. Get eye level with them. I'm looking at you. I see you. You're very angry right now. You are so angry. I'm here. Instead of, oh God, here you go again, you know, flipping out about the wrong kind of pancakes and I do everything I can and every morning is chaos here. And they're just internalizing all of that. Not only do they have their initial stress to grapple with, now they've got your response to it to grapple with and their chronic concern that they're disappointing you in some way. So just helping these parents understand you can cool down much faster any degree of meltdown, it doesn't matter how severe it is, by getting down on this child's level, looking them in the eye, extend your hands, don't grab their hands, extend them, like I'm here to hold your hands if you're interested in that. Hold your arms out like I can give you a hug if you want that. If you don't, that's fine too. I see you and I'm here and that's it. You don't elaborate. You don't, why are you feeling this way? Why are you upset? What triggered you? Blah, blah, blah. Like just be quiet. Just be quiet and be present. And show them that you're here and that you see their feelings. You can see that their experience is overwhelming them right now and you're here. And that makes such a huge difference for these kids, just that one intervention.
I think you're right about the understanding piece in the sense that, hey, we see a two-year-old or a toddler melt down for something. You're like, look, we totally expect that. And so therefore you have that understanding. You're like, okay, yes, you don't know how to, you know, process this emotion because you're two. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. If we can give them those piece of information, be like, you are having a tough time processing this thing because this is my child and this is how they process this thing. So we can all get on the same page. And I'm starting to see some of those similarities. Not that I, clearly I need more, you know, education as well. So thank you for coming on this podcast to chat about this. But I'm hoping that with some of these understanding pieces, plus the resource sheet that you have, we can make a big difference.
That's my hope. I think that these kids are at the root of our mental health epidemic in pediatrics, especially with our adolescent and teenage population. And honestly, at the root of the adult mental health epidemic too, is a bunch of highly sensitive parents parenting highly sensitive children, and all parties are off the rails. And understanding who they are and why they're different and what makes them tick and why their reaction to things is so different from other people and how they can learn to cope with that and thrive, not in spite of that, but with that. Because really we need highly sensitive people, like highly sensitive people who are raised well and are comfortable in their own skin and have learned, you know, self, emotional regulation skills and how to, you know, take space for themselves and mindfulness skills. Like these are the people you want to hire in the workforce. They're the people you want to be your child's physician or your child's teacher or the president. Like these kids, you know, turn into adults who are really highly successful. We just have to help them get there. And so it's important, I think, for, you know, these parents to understand, like, these kids actually have a higher potential to thrive. And we just have to kind of adjust our sails a little bit in terms of parenting them and interacting with them so that they can reach their full above average potential instead of ending up below average for their potential because of, you know, their epigenetics, basically their experience of life.
Kaylin, I want to say, as a highly sensitive person myself, in the last hour, I've just learned so much about myself, and every word you said was so, so relatable to me. And I was wondering, especially for older kids, like even now, I often deal with, and highly sensitive kids often deal with big feelings, like you said, or thoughts and worries that become obsessive. So especially for, you talked a lot about the strategies for parents and their conversations with toddlers and younger kids, but for adolescents and older kids, what strategies do you advise for HSCs for developing coping strategies or things that they could do on their own when worries become really big or thoughts?
Yeah, for sure. So these are kids, adolescents, young adults who can really change their experience of the world through mindfulness practices, but you kind of have to get them on board with it. And I have found a really successful sales strategy to them is helping them understand the like actual neurobiology and pathophysiology of what's going on. Your nervous system is very finely tuned. That's why you can feel things, see things, notice things more than other people. That's why you process things very deeply. It's why you think so carefully about your answer to questions or about your course of action. Because of that, your nervous system can very quickly flip into fight or flight mode. And that just kind of takes your rational brain completely offline. And you're just in, you know, survival mode. And so your heart's racing, your palms are sweaty, you're stressed out, you're shaky, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, when that's happening, here are the things that happen in your body. Your pH changes, your breathing pattern changes. Here's what you can do to reverse that physiology, change your body, and then that will trickle back into your brain. And suddenly you'll feel yourself kind of coming back down, you know, to the earth. Your feet will approach the ground again. And I think if, like, I've seen that if I just come at it from like almost more of a scientific approach, regardless of if the kid is interested in science or not, that just seems to resonate more with them than me telling them like, oh, you just need to take deep breaths and calm down. And, you know, they're like, oh, okay, doc, I'll definitely do that. Sounds like it'll totally work. So helping them understand that there are genuine physical changes in their body when they do deep breathing exercises, box breathing. A big one that I like to recommend is the 874, 478 breaths. So breathing in for 8, holding for 7, exhaling for 4. And you can think about the inhale, exhale pathology, right? Like, what would that do to your blood gas? How could that change the respiratory acidosis that you're dealing with in a stressful situation from hyperventilation? And, you know, just giving them very concrete things. And then same for them, just helping them understand who they are. Like, here's some resources for you. And you're going to listen to all of this and think, yeah, huh. And helping them understand that it's 20% of people and they're not alone. There's lots of people that experience that. Pointing them to highly, you know, successful, sensitive adults. So Alanis Morissette made a documentary, I think it's called Sensitive, a while ago, probably a decade ago. Like, she's a great example. And she talks about her upbringing and how that kind of impacted her. And like, look at her, she's super successful, you know, musician. And looking at one of my, you know, huge heroes is Anne Lamott. She's a author, dealt with tremendous adversity through, you know, childhood into her adulthood, even addiction, all kinds of things. And she kind of pulled herself through, and she's definitely highly sensitive. And now she's just this like tremendously adapted person, this like pillar of acceptance of your experience in reality and being okay with that and, you know, just being calm perpetually. And she actually has a really cool TED talk. Oh gosh, what's it called? Like, The Truths I Learned from Life and Writing, 12 Truths I Learned from Life and Writing. And I send teenagers and parents to that all the time because it's such a meaningful, what, you know, 8 or 9 minutes of her explaining what highly sensitive people experience in the world. And you just, if you're a highly sensitive person or a highly sensitive parent or a non-highly sensitive parent dealing with a highly sensitive child, it all just resonates so much with you. And I think it just, it offers some degree of hope and excitement for what your trait means for your potential in the future, so that you're not just wrapped up in, oh, my nervous system is just like constantly on high alert and I'm always stressed, I'm always anxious, this is just my lot in life. No, like, you have potential to change the world. We just need to help you cope with your big feelings.
I was going to say, as a follow-up to the last question, what do you advise for highly sensitive adolescents who are transitioning to adulthood or college life? So, for example, they might not feel ready or comfortable to just move across the country so far away from their home and support system. So how do they typically adjust to living in communal places like dorms, and how do you advise them in terms of this transition?
So I think it's important for them, two things. They have to find kind of a a support system, an anchor system, if you will, in both places. So they have to understand that you have this anchor back home, you have this support system back home, hopefully, that you can always go back to. It doesn't matter if you're on a different continent. You always have the, you know, this group of people who understand you, support you, that you can go back to for advice and for understanding and for guidance on how to process all that life is throwing at you as an adult, because it is very different, you know, than as a kid. And then kind of empowering them to find a support system in wherever their new space is, you know, seeking out healthy friendships is an important one. It's easy for these teenagers and young adults to be severely influenced by peer pressure because they think so much about what other people think of them, and they really want to please people constantly, and they can become pathological people pleasers. And so they want to do things to fit in, basically. So try to empower them to find the right people to spend time with and to trust and rely on. And then really there's a third really important piece that's empowering them themselves. Like, you are capable. Maybe you don't feel capable right now. You might feel very nervous, and that makes sense. You're terrified. You're afraid of this and this, and afraid of things that you haven't even thought about to be afraid of yet. And that makes good sense. And you're going to do fine. You're ready for this. You're capable. You have XYZ supports in place, and everything's going to do fine. And just kind of empower them. You know, these kids can fall into a sick role, kind of like, oh, I'm highly sensitive. I really love this sport, but, you know, I always get hurt, and then I cry a lot easier than my peers. And then my teammates are making fun of me, and my coach tells me to buck up, and I can't deal with that. And then I cry harder, and then I can't play at all. And so forget it. I can't play soccer. It's just not something that I can do. Flip that script. You can play soccer. You can advocate for yourself. You can help people around you understand who you are. And most importantly, you can be confident in who you are, and you're fine. There's nothing wrong with you. This is how you experience the world. This is how they experience the world. And they're both fine. They're both normal.
I love that. You have been alluding to throughout this talk the fact that this is a topic that is really exploding in a lot of different facets of life, including education and parenting. And we're trying to bring it to medicine, which I love. My question is, what areas of uncertainty still remain, and what areas of research still need to be explored further in this world, in this highly sensitive children domain?
You know, again, like a dream of mine is to do some sort of project to identify a scale for babies, because I think that the earlier you can even just plant the seed, maybe you're wrong. I feel like I'm not. I want to do the research to find out. But even just planting the seed, because everything you're guiding a parent to do for a highly sensitive child that's so critically important for them and their success is not bad for the other 80% of kids. It's all great for them too. So you're not going to hurt a kid by recommending the highly sensitive parenting strategies. I mean, really, I think it's just a matter of education. I mean, we have awesome fMRI studies that show the way that these kids and people light up differently. They all like light up, you know, in their insula and the seat of consciousness, the place where you're wrapping all of these various neurological pathways together and bringing information together to process it. They light up in their amygdala, the emotional processing and an expression center. So we have, you know, MRI evidence of this. We have the genetic sequence. I mean, you can theoretically blood test these kids for this. And the genes that are involved in it are, you know, regulating serotonin degradation. It's MAOA. It's, you know, dopamine receptors. All of it. You know, makes good sense. And we have good research through trauma literature, addiction literature, Parkinson's literature about these various genes that we can tease out in highly sensitive people that explain, you know, how they experience the world and the traits, you know, that are present. So the science is there. It's people just don't know. They don't know about it. And they do, you know, especially the highly sensitive people know that they're different from everybody else. And these parents know that their kids are a little different, but they don't have the terminology for it, or they don't understand that it's normal, and not just normal, but kind of a great thing.
Well, hopefully with this episode, you know, more people will know about this and then be able to sort of spread the word even more. I really, really want to thank you for spending the time with us today to discuss this obviously very passionate topic for you and something that I think a lot of us learned a lot about. As we sort of wrap up, are there any main take-home points you want our listeners to take away from this?
I'm going to empower all of our listeners. There are not a lot of things that a general pediatrician can feel like a hero about. We don't get to cure cancer. We don't put bones back together. But this is something that you can really change the trajectory of a child's life, of a family's life, of a parent's life, just helping them understand themselves maybe. And it's relatively simple. I know there's a million things that we have to screen for and talk about and forget all the paperwork and the vaccines and everything else that has to be done in a well child check. But this is really impactful. This is something that doesn't take that much time and you can truly change the course of that child's life.
That's awesome. That's really great. Hopefully everyone takes that to heart, all our listeners, because I definitely will after this. Before we let you go, and I know you already gave us you're going to be giving us a bunch of resources that we're going to throw in our show notes, because I know our show notes are going to be a plethora of resources. Mm-hmm. Is there anything just in particular you wanted to plug before you went? It doesn't even have to be necessarily about the topic, just anything you want our listeners to know about.
No, I think, you know, just looking into these resources, and you can just Google it. There's lots of information out there. We just have to be experienced with it. And that's kind of my goal, is to sort of come at it as a medical professional to medical professionals to help all of us understand it. First, pediatricians, because kids are going to become adults. Like, if we can help them understand that early, things will be different. But just looking into it, spending a little bit of time. I always tell the residents, nobody's going to give you a great breastfeeding curriculum, but that's critically important for you as a pediatrician. You're just going to have to spend 4 hours really digging into how to support breastfeeding success, and you'll be so much better as a pediatrician. So spend 4 hours learning about sensitivity, the trait. You can watch my, Grand Rounds on YouTube. You literally just look up, Dayton Children's Highly Sensitive Child, and there I am. You can, look at the various things that we'll plug in the show notes, listen to some of the podcasts on your way to or from work, and just a couple of hours will help you understand these kids, help you identify these kids better, help them understand themselves better, and help their parents understand them better, and everything changes after that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We had a great time talking to you. We need to get you back sometime for some other discussions. I think it'll be great.
I would love to be back again. Thank you guys so much for having me and for letting me share this information with everybody. The number you have dialed has been changed. The new number
is... This has been another episode of the Cribsiders.
It's
Get show notes and sign up for our weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feed newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producers for this episode, Dr. Rachel Holloway and Mayor Graywall, and our wonderful social media team,
Denise Cruz
on X and Instagram. I've been Sam Mazur.
I've been Rachel Holloway.
I've been Mayor Graywall.
And this has been Chris the G-Man Chew. Thank you and good night. And for those who have made it all the way to the end, you're going to have a treat, because I have another poem written by AI. This one's labeled The Hidden Rainbow. Some children feel the world so deep, each texture, sound, and light they keep. The highly sensitive child perceives more than what others may believe. Like antenna tuned so fine, they sense the subtle by design, each emotion bright and strong, sometimes where they don't belong. Overwhelmed by clothing tags, by noisy rooms and fluorescent flags, yet their empathy runs pure and true, seeing shades that others never knew. In quiet spaces they can thrive, their creativity comes alive. These children teach us how to see. The world's full of sensitivity. See you guys.